Welcome back to the Deep Dive. Today we're tackling utilitarianism, a pretty big name in moral theory. And it's a topic you, our listener, pointed us towards with some really interesting sources. So what is it? Well, at its core, it's the idea that, you know, the best action is the one that maximizes happiness and minimizes suffering. Seems simple enough, right?
Yeah, that initial simplicity is definitely part of its appeal. It's a moral framework that tries to ground right and wrong in something we all sort of experience pleasure and pain. What's really fascinating, though, is the journey this idea has taken and, you know, the debates it sparked.
Absolutely. And leading that journey, we've got Jeremy Bentham, the original architect, you could say, and then John Stuart Mill, who's probably its most famous defender. Now, the idea of pleasure being the ultimate good, that's been around for ages, hasn't it? Your sources kind of hinted at some ancient connections.
They did, yeah. The roots go back to ancient hedonism, with thinkers like Epicurus suggesting pleasure as life's main goal. But Bentham's big innovation was really developing this into a concrete system for, like, making ethical decisions. He focused on the greatest happiness for the greatest number, not just, you know, individual pleasure. So while the pleasure concept is old, Bentham gave us a specific influential brand of it.
Okay. So the central idea, as I got from the material, is that we judge actions and policies by whether they tend to, you know, increase overall happiness. It's all about the consequences, the impact on well-being.
Precisely. That focus on consequences is key. And action is morally right if it produces the most good for the most people. And like you said, one of the initial attractions of utilitarianism is it seems pretty straightforward compared to, say, Kant's rules or virtue ethics or even social contract stuff in natural law. Those can get complex.
Right. I mean, telling people to aim for pleasure and avoid pain, it almost feels like common sense, doesn't it? But then we dive into the specifics, starting with Bentham and his act utilitarianism. Okay, let's unpack this a bit. His principle of utility. It's all about judging actions based on whether they boost or reduce happiness. And something that really stood out was his view on who counts in this calculation.
That's a really important point. Yeah. Bentham was, well, pretty ahead of his time, arguing that we should give equal weight to the happiness and suffering of all sentient beings, anyone capable of feeling pleasure and, crucially, pain. That includes animals.
Animals, too. Wow.
Yeah. He believed their capacity to suffer gives them a moral claim, regardless of species. It was a big shift from the, you know, human-centered views common back then.
Definitely. And then he developed this pleasure-pain calculus, almost like a scientific approach to ethics. 7 factors. Mm-hmm. Intensity, duration, certainty, propinquity, nearness, fecundity, purity, and extent. Sounds incredibly detailed.
It was. Bentham lived when science was making huge leaps, right? So he wanted to bring that kind of precision to moral reasoning. But, you know, what's interesting there is the inherent subjectivity. Can we really put a number on the purity of a pleasure? Yeah. Does that number mean the same thing for everyone in every situation? It raises questions about, like, the limits of measuring experience.
Yeah, good point. The source gave a helpful example of the neighbor's book. You need it, can't afford it, thinking about swiping it. Running that through Bentham's 7 criteria, it doesn't look good for the thief, does it?
Not at all, no. If you think about the neighbor's pain, losing the book, feeling wronged, and weigh that against the thief's maybe temporary pleasure, especially if they feel guilty later, and then the broader impact if stealing became common.
Yeah.
Yeah, the calculus pretty clearly says stealing is wrong in this framework. It shows how he meant it as a practical tool for choices.
Okay, so that's Bentham's take. But then Mill steps in. And he felt Bentham's view might be a little, well, the source quoted a pretty harsh criticism, a doctrine worthy of swine. Ouch.
Yeah, that was a significant critique. It really hit at a perceived weakness in Bentham's approach, you know. The worry was that by focusing only on pleasure, utilitarianism seemed to reduce human life to just basic animal desires, eating, sleeping, that sort of thing.
Yeah.
The argument was humans are capable of so much more, and a moral theory should reflect that.
And Mill's response was to argue that, well, not all pleasures are created equal. He brought in this idea of higher pleasures that humans can experience because we have more developed cognitive, emotional, imaginative faculties.
Exactly. Mill made this crucial distinction between pleasures of sensation, the kind we share with animals, and these pleasures of intellect and feeling.
Hmm.
Think about, like, a dog enjoying a belly rub versus the satisfaction of solving a tough problem or appreciating music.
Right, or like reading Dostoevsky versus eating spaghetti, as the source put it.
Exactly. Or poetry versus video games. Mill argued these higher pleasures aren't just more intense or longer lasting, they're qualitatively different, superior.
And he had this qualitative test, right? ask people who've experienced both kinds which they genuinely prefer, and that preference, regardless of obligation, would show the higher pleasure.
Yes. Mill believed that those familiar with both higher and lower pleasures will almost always choose the higher ones, even if they come with more challenges or less immediate gratification. This led to his famous quote, "It is better to be a human being dissatisfied than a pig satisfied. Better to be Socrates dissatisfied than a fool satisfied."
Explain that a bit more.
The idea is that the capacity for these higher experiences, even with potential for frustration, is a more valuable and ultimately more fulfilling state of being.
Well, what about people who seem to consistently go for those lower pleasures? You know, the source mentioned folks preferring mindless entertainment over, say, intellectual stuff. How did Mill explain that?
Mill suggested that a consistent preference for lower pleasures by those capable of higher ones often indicates an infirmity of character, or maybe a loss of the ability to appreciate higher pleasures, perhaps from neglect or even addiction. He didn't see it as proof lower pleasures are actually better, but more like a failing or diminished capacity in the person.
But isn't there a risk there of being a bit elitist, maybe? Like, who defines higher pleasures? Doesn't that depend on culture or background?
That's a really sharp point, and definitely a debate that's still relevant today.
Absolutely.
It raises questions about cultural biases creeping in.
Okay. Now, Mill also had some interesting ideas about what makes for a satisfied life and how society could aim for greater happiness overall.
He did. Mill saw a satisfied life as having a balance of excitement and tranquility, but with tranquility being sort of the more fundamental part. He identified selfishness and a lack of mental cultivation as the two main barriers to achieving this kind of satisfied life.
Mental cultivation, that seems key for him. He thought education wasn't just about skills, but about unlocking deeper happiness and even tackling societal problems.
Absolutely. Mill saw a cultivated mind finding inexhaustible interest in all that surrounds it. It leads to a richer life for the individual and makes them better contributors to society. He was pretty optimistic about progress, believing that through, you know, societal wisdom and science, we could eventually beat things like poverty and disease.
That optimism about conquering disease, your source did raise an interesting point there, given, you know, pandemics and viruses today. It makes you wonder if he'd be quite as confident now.
It does, yeah. It's a fair question. But regardless, his vision of societal betterment is a really important part of his utilitarianism.
Definitely. Now, despite its appeal and Mill's refinements, the source has also brought up some pretty serious criticisms. Let's get into those.
Indeed. Yeah, the goal of maximizing happiness is great, but the theory hits some big hurdles in practice. First is the problem of application. How do we actually know the consequences of our actions? Predicting the future, especially with complex human stuff, is notoriously hard.
Right. We're not fortune tellers. Even with good intentions, actions can have unintended negative results later on. Mill argued we learn from the past, but like the source said, the future isn't just a repeat, especially with new situations.
And building on that difficulty of prediction, another major challenge, which the source really digs into, is justice.
Ah, yes, the justice problem.
Exactly. Because utilitarianism is so focused on outcomes maximizing overall happiness, it can lead to some really troubling conclusions about individual rights and fairness. It seems like it could potentially justify actions that just feel deeply wrong if they result in a net happiness increase for the majority.
The source used that really disturbing thought experiment, the one about a society benefiting from slavery, even if a small group suffers terribly. Even if you could somehow argue the overall happiness is greater, and that's a massive if, it just feels fundamentally unjust, doesn't it?
That's precisely the core of the justice problem for utilitarianism. Our gut feeling about justice and individual rights clashes with the purely results-based logic. Basic utilitarianism doesn't have a built-in way to protect rights or ensure fairness if violating them leads to a better overall pleasure-pain balance. That fundamental difference is where a lot of the sharpest criticism comes from.
And this leads right into the problem of rights. The Peeping Tom example in the source really brought this home. Someone gets pleasure in violating privacy, but the victim doesn't know, so they don't feel pain. Utilitarianism seems to struggle to condemn that.
It does. Because the pleasure pain calculation in that specific case might not show a net negative. The voyeur gets pleasure. The victim feels no pain. The theory has trouble accounting for the inherent wrongness of violating someone's autonomy, their right to privacy.
Yeah.
It really highlights the limits of only focusing on total pleasure and pain without considering individual entitlements or moral boundaries.
Okay, then there's the problem of demands. if we're always morally obligated to maximize pleasure and minimize pain for everyone, that feels incredibly overwhelming, almost impossible day to day. Like, we should constantly be alleviating suffering, so pursuing our own interests or talents might seem wrong if that time could be spent helping others more directly. I know I felt guilty about leisure time sometimes, knowing there's suffering out there.
Yeah, that feeling of constant obligation, the potential guilt, that really gets to the heart of this criticism. Utilitarianism, in its purest form, struggles to distinguish between required actions and those that are just good or admirable, but not strictly our duty, what philosophers call supererogatory.
Supererogatory, right.
If the standard is always maximizing happiness, then things we usually think are praiseworthy but optional, like dedicating lots of time to art or even just relaxing, could be seen as morally wrong if that time could have been used more directly to help those in need.
So, okay, to try and address some of these really big criticisms, especially around justice and rights, the idea of rule utilitarianism came about, right?
Exactly. Rule utilitarianism is an attempt to kind of reconcile the utilitarian goal with the need for clear moral rules and protecting rights. Instead of judging each individual action by its immediate consequences, rule utilitarianism says we should evaluate general rules. Would widespread acceptance of this rule lead to the greatest overall happiness in the long run?
So instead of asking, will this specific act lead to the most pleasure right now, you ask, would a general rule allowing this kind of action, if everyone followed it, lead to the most overall happiness? The source mentioned a connection to social contract ideas, like constitutions and bills of rights, as examples of trying to set up societal rules aiming for overall well-being and protecting rights.
That's a great analogy, yeah. The idea is by setting up and consistently following just rules, even if breaking the rule in one specific instance might seem to produce a bit more immediate pleasure, the overall well-being and stability of society are better served long-term. It's trying to build justice and rights into the framework at the level of principles, not just case by case.
Fascinating. So today's deep dive really took us through the core of utilitarianism. We looked at Bentham's foundational work, The Calculus, Equal Consideration, then Mill's big step with qualitative pleasures and his optimism, and then those really important tough criticisms, application, justice, rights, the demands it makes. And finally, rule utilitarianism as a response. It's a theory with huge influence and, you know, for good reason, wanting more happiness and less suffering is powerful, but turning that into a full workable moral system that's clearly complex and still being debated.
Absolutely. And maybe for you, our listener, thinking about the strengths and weaknesses we discuss, how might utilitarianism inform or maybe clash with current debates? Think about AI ethics, resource allocation, animal welfare. What kinds of pleasure and pain do we as individuals and as a society tend to prioritize? And what crucial aspects might we be overlooking in this constant chase for well-being? Definitely a lot to chew on. Thanks for diving deep with us.